The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. I'm Leonard Maltin. This is Maltin on Movies. Farron Vaughn is not here today, but I am here with two very special guests. They're old friends of mine, and they've been enjoying modest success of late, which we'll talk about. They are screenwriters and film buffs extraordinaire, and their names are Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski. Scott, why don't you identify yourself vocally?
Hi, Leonard. This is Scott.
It sure is.
Hello, Leonard. Good to be here. This is Larry Karaszewski.
Well, hi, fellas. Now, I knew these guys a long, long time ago when they were just getting started out, and they sold their first script, and Scott's wife was working at Entertainment Tonight the same time I was, and we got friendly and acquainted. And they've had a long and successful career. And they made their mark by writing films about real people, screenplays about real people like Ed Wood, and real people like Larry Flint in The People versus Larry Flint, and Andy Kaufman in Man in the Moon, which Jim Carrey played so well. And they've worked with all sorts of people, and they've had a very good and enduring career. And just lately, they've gotten a little of attention, you know, buzz for this miniseries called The People versus OJ. Yes, those guys.
Yep.
Those guys are here. And I'm the only one interviewing them this month who isn't going to talk that much about The People versus OJ.
You say that much, but I we'll see. We'll see at the end of the
year. We double dare you.
Scott and I joked that it's ruined every dinner party we've gone to for the past 3 years because, you know, as you go around and say, hey, what do you do? I'm working on this OJ Simpson thing.
And there was breaking news just like 20 minutes ago, but we're not going to talk about it.
But it's like all people want to talk about it at all times.
I know. Well, I'll be the exception.
Okay, fine.
I'll be the exception. I mean, we'll get to that.
Leonard understands film history. He isn't just about the moment.
That's right. That's right. I see context.
Yeah.
I see in you guys' context. Well, what I really want to ask you is...
So we'll talk about Capricorn 1 and Naked Gun and Towering Inferno. There's a way of working around the subject.
That's right.
The Klansman.
Goldie and the Boxer.
That's Goldie and the Boxer.
No, I'm serious. These guys really are film fanatics. Yes. We are brothers under the skin because we share this passion and love for movies. And Scott, you have a little piece of immortality on YouTube, do you not?
Do I?
Well, yeah, because you're in the audience where Orson Welles came to USC.
Oh, you know about that.
Yeah, well, you told me about it.
Okay. I mean, Orson Welles was always one of my heroes, like many of us. And I technically met him one time where I was actually speaking with him and he was shaking my hand. I was about 12 years old in Burt Wheeler's magic shop on Hollywood Boulevard. And I was a kid magician who used to do birthday parties, and Orson Welles walks in to buy a new coin trick because he's going to be on the Merv Griffin show. and the guy like pulls out a half dollar and starts showing Orson how to do it. And Orson basically grabs me, you know, hey kid, you know, let me try out, you know, let me see if I can pull the half dollar out of your ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I was just ready to fall over. I was so excited. So that was my first brush with Orson. Then a few years later, Larry and I were freshmen at USC, and Orson, this is getting deep into trivia really quickly here, was making a documentary about his film, The Trial. He had earlier done a movie, I don't know, he just started doing a lot of recycling, where he'd done a movie about the making of Othello.
Mm-hmm.
So this was going to be a similar vein. So he showed the trial, and then he just basically had USC film, you know, Leonard, you know the theater quite well since you mm-hmm. taught there, you know, get 350 kids to show up, and we would ask him questions. And because Orson was really lean and mean in 1981 with – very skimpy production facilities. He had his DP, Gary Graver, who strangely years later, Larry and I became friends with. And Gary was the entire crew. He was lighting. He was the operator. He was the film loader. And so you've got a Q&A with a guy on stage talking to 350 people, but only one cameraman. And if you think about that, so I
a lot of whip pans.
Yeah, a lot of whip pans, and I can remember very distinctly this this very sweaty young blonde guy running up and down the aisle frantically with these whip pans, trying to grab Orson, then trying to grab the answer. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to be overly clever, trying to ask. Or it's like my trick in life is if you get to talk to someone famous, you ask them something no one else has asked them about.
Yeah, I subscribe to that too.
Yeah, it's like you don't say, "What do you think of Citizen Kane?" You just don't ask that question. So the opening of the wow, this is trivia. The opening of the trial. You can cut all this out later. You don't have to actually use this in the podcast. The opening of the trial is pin screen animation, mm-hmm. which is something I was familiar with from the International Tourney of Animation, this mm-hmm. show that used to run with Gene Marsh on PBS. Mm-hmm. Wow, you can cut everything out, I said.
And you can't talk about it here. Where can you talk about it?
It's this really esoteric type of animation where you arrange a tabletop of nails or pins. And then by tilting them to the left and right, you create shadows and you create images by filming it from above. And I was a fan of this kind of weird Eastern European animation. And so
– Look, Google Alexeyev.
Okay.
If you're at home, just Google
okay.
Alexeyev. You can find this stuff.
And so that was my question to the great Orson Welles was, let's talk about pin screen animation, which certainly grabbed his attention when I was 18 years old. And then that was the last I ever thought about it. And then just like magic, about 2 or 3 years ago, the entire raw footage from that event, all 90 minutes, just got uploaded onto YouTube very mysteriously. I had looked for it. And when I became friends with Gary, 1,000 years later, I asked Gary about it. And he said, oh, I think it's in the Munich Film Archive or something. He says, but I'll call them up and I'll try to get it for you because – if you're in it, that's crazy. And then Gary died, mm-hmm. and then I didn't know who to follow up with. And so it's magical. And I can watch myself at the age of 18 talking to Orson Welles.
Wow. Right. Well, of course, you know, it's
what a boring story.
What's magical is what turns up on YouTube. That's what's magical.
Exactly.
The astonishing things that turn up there.
Well, we had gotten contacted by Gary Graver actually about we were one of those very many people over the years who attempted to get The Other Side of the Wind finished.
Yes.
So we've seen dailies and
this is the now legendary / notorious unfinished Orson Welles right. feature film.
Right. Trim bin outtakes. Mm-hmm. There's so much footage in that thing that maybe someday they keep on every few years someone announces that they've figured out a way to finish it. But
it was really sad because the. There is a lot of really incredible finished footage from that movie. I mean, mm-hmm. just gorgeous stuff. And Gary showed us the footage. And Gary spent years lugging around the work print, which was, for you old-timers, double system. So it was one can of mag, which was the sound, and one can of picture, and each reel. So it's a lot of cans of film he's carrying around. It was about 45 minutes. And He had a whole post-production schedule, and this is how much to buy the rights, and this is how much to edit it. And Larry and I tried to use the teeny-weeny bit of pull we thought we had to get, a few heads of production and a couple studios to watch this footage. And we opened a few doors for Gary, and we set up a few screenings, and we thought, oh, my God, this is, for, $1 million, a studio can have a new Orson Welles movie mm-hmm. in color – with swearing and nudity. So it is a modern film.
And it stars John Huston.
I mean, the movie's got some really cool stuff in it. And
well, what's very cool about it is that it's a movie by an old master, but done in the sort of early 70s New Hollywood style.
Well, it's making fun mm-hmm. of that style.
Right, mm-hmm. but I'm saying that so you get this weird mixture that you don't usually get. I mean, mm-hmm. Or if you get it, it's a disaster. It's Otto Preminger doing Skidoo, mm-hmm. But it's if someone ever puts it together, the pieces are very, very fascinating. And we were very interested in Gary because we always looked at – Gary Graver's relationship to Orson was really similar to Ed Wood's relationship with Bela Lugosi. The way some of these kind of older Hollywood mm-hmm. people have a younger hanger-on who just sort of takes care of him.
And that's why Gary tracked us down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we actually had that scene in Ed Wood where Ed Wood meets Orson Welles.
Now you don't have yourself at age 18 on YouTube, do you, Larry?
I do, actually.
Actually, at 17 and 16.
Yeah, I've got a lot of stuff on YouTube from that period. I was a part of a television show in the Midwest in Indiana called Beyond Our Control during my high school years, and it was kind of a sketch comedy show, but it was actually created before SNL and before Second City TV, but it was very much of that ilk. It was it was basically a television show that made fun of television shows, and I was a part of that with Daniel Waters, who eventually wrote Heathers and Batman Returns, Dean Norris, who was Hank on Breaking Bad.
Oh, he was on that show?
Yeah. Yeah, you know that. That's how we know him.
No, I knew you were friends. Oh. I didn't realize he was
in the skits. Yeah, he was in that. The woman who invented Blue's Clues. This whole little group of people from South Bend, Indiana. Chris Webber wrote Toy Story 2. We were taught to be professionals very early on, and that stuff started to leak a couple years back onto YouTube. So there's a lot of me doing, me pretending to be John Houseman in a paper chase parody or something.
And they can also see you quite often on Trailers from Hell.
Yes.
Wonderful and addictive website.
Right.
Which people don't know about, they should.
Yeah.
Where you show an original movie trailer, introduce it, and then offer commentary on it.
Right. No, Joe Dante runs, the director, runs that website. And when he invited me to join, I was really pleased because I was a film critic for a brief period. I studied film criticism at USC. And so it actually gave me an outlet to discuss crazy movies that maybe people have forgotten.
It gave Larry a way to bludgeon people with early 70s cinema.
Well, most people don't need to be bludgeoned for that. They need to be bludgeoned for other esoterica, but early 70s
There's a lot of forgotten Sally Kellerman and Michael Sarrazin pictures. Yes, yes. Larry wants the world to know about them.
Yeah. Well, I'll be with you on Slither then.
So, ooh, Slither. You
know, wow. There we go.
There we go.
We can have fun with that.
First swearing I ever heard in a movie theater.
Really?
In Slither.
Right. It was his dad. It wasn't in the movie. His dad stubbed his toe walking into the crest.
I think Sally Kellerman says shit.
Oh.
And I was sitting in between my parents, and I was so embarrassed.
Goodness gracious.
Right. I'm gonna interrupt for 1 second. I'm gonna remember my first nudity in the movie theater was my mom.
It was yours.
Yeah, was this guy in the next stall? No, it was my mom. Took me to see the sequel to In the Heat of the Night, which was They Call Me Mr. Tibbs.
Yeah,
and we sit down, and the movie starts, and the first scene is a nude prostitute being murdered.
Really?
Yeah, and it's just like she's screaming at the camera, and my mom just said, "I shouldn't have taken you to this." I just learned to be quiet, and I should just watch.
Rated R?
It was rated, I think, either GP or M. Back in the old days, GP, yes, yes. You get a
GP with nudity?
Oh, GP's nudity all over the early 70s.
Really?
Yeah, there's tons of GP nudity.
Different standards. Standards.
I mean, Walkabout's GP for crying out loud.
Now,
Walkabout really GP?
Yeah.
Because she's naked in that movie.
Yeah. Wow. You can measure the changes in societal, reactions to these things by watching the MPAA ratings over the years. It's really true. Now, your first success was, if I'm not mistaken, was the movie Problem Child. Was that your first?
Purportedly.
Right, yes. Right. Depends your definition of success, but sure.
Sold and produced screenplay.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
So
yes,
it was. In terms
and
of
it made a lot of money.
Right.
Made a lot of money. And a sequel, two
sequels. In terms of career.
Yeah.
And you got to write a second one. And there was a spin-off TV series, right?
Yes. When you say we got to, it makes it sound like it was a present or something.
Well, you'll love this. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, we wrote Problem Child as sort of a dark satire and whatever. We've come to terms in how the movie is now because people who were 10 when they saw it are now 30, and they seemed to really mean something.
They now think it's like some like it hot.
Right. But I remember we're in doing the sequel, and the problem is when you're an unproduced screenwriter, you can always imagine your greatness.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've made a couple movies and they're Problem Child 1 and Problem Child 2, you know basically what the plate is. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were at the Universal Commissary and we were eating and we were underneath a poster for Ma and Pa Kettle film.
Oh, yeah, one of the later sequels.
And I was like, we're the dudes who wrote the Ma and Pa Kettle sequels. I was like, that's the card that was dealt us. And so I think that's one of the reasons we wound up abandoning that and writing Ed Wood on spec.
Was that your next project then?
Yes.
Well, no. After Problem Child 1 and 2, we tried to go sell some smarty pants, clever movies, and people wouldn't pay us to write those movies because they had no faith in us because our only credits were The Problem Childs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we ended up writing Ed Wood on spec,
right,
which was the sort and of proof to
– For those who don't know, just for people who aren't in the biz and no jargon, on spec means no one has paid you to do this. You're doing it on your own time, on your own dime too, hoping to sell it. As opposed to being commissioned to write it.
I love the fact that Scott just did 20 minutes of completely obscure stuff, but that's the point that you have to explain. He just went off.
Told him to Google Alexander Alexiev for pin screen animation. Yeah, I did my job.
I'm really curious to see if Leonard cuts all that out.
You'll never know.
You'll never know.
Wait and see.
You know what's weird? I just realized for the first time that every time we work with Tim Burton, we don't get paid.
That's funny.
Isn't that strange?
They're labors of love.
Yes. So what happened? You wrote this script for Ed Wood. First thing you did was you used your love of movie history and movie arcana to tackle a subject that was not exactly a mainstream subject.
And it was also – I mean, it was very autobiographical. I mean the impetus was that the Problem Child movies were cruddy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this idea that no one sets out to make a bad movie.
Right.
Everyone – I mean I came up with like my Scott – like three rules of Hollywood when you're trying to break in, which is your first goal is to sell a script. Your second goal is to get a movie made. Your third goal is to get a good movie made.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to number two, when you're getting a movie made, you're always dreaming that it's going to turn out wonderful. But most movies just – turn out awful, and Tim Burton used to joke that he once ran the making of a movie through some computer algorithm, and it said it's impossible because there's just so many moving parts.
Yeah,
and so we were very frustrated with sort of our lot in life in that moment because we thought we were better than people thought we were,
mm-hmm.
and so we started looking at Ed Wood not as the guy that the medbeds were making fun of, as this figure of mockery.
And just at this point, I should just, I guess, parenthetically explain. Right. If you don't know the movie Ed Wood, you should. It's a wonderful movie.
You're not listening to this podcast if you haven't seen it.
I would think so. But Edward D. Wood Jr. was the notorious and notoriously untalented filmmaker behind such classic awful movies or awfully wonderful movies or wonderfully awful movies as Plan 9 from Outer Space and Glenn or Glenda. That's my little interjection. Right.
And what Scott was referring to about the Medveds were brothers that wrote that
– They were named Harry and Michael Medved.
That wrote books in the late 70s, early 80s about the worst films of all time.
Right.
And that's really where Ed Wood was such an obscure figure. He really wasn't on the map. It wasn't like he was – people talked about him until he wound up in these books and when he was named the worst director of all time. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden then it became this sort of roadshow that went to all revival houses where people would come to the movies and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And I think having the Problem Child experience, it made Scott and I say, wait a second, what if you make a movie about Ed Wood, but you're not making fun of Ed?
Yeah.
You're
celebrating him.
Yeah, you're celebrating him. You're saying, oh, wait a second, this guy came out to Hollywood and he made a lot of films. And some of them are really, if you're not laughing at them, you're actually kind of weird and personal. He was putting his own weird fetishes on screen.
He sure was. Yeah. So you pursued this script.
Yeah. I mean, all of our scripts are secretly autobiographical, and whether they are biographies of real people or whether it's a horror movie about John Cusack trapped in a hotel room, we put lots of our own lives and quirky experiences into our scripts. And I mean, for myself, my life is a total blur right now. I had spent a number of years in the early to mid 80s crewing on low budget horror films,
mm-hmm.
Which was really sort of an important experience for me. It was my first time being on a real movie set. These were $200,000 to $300,000 slasher films. I was a PA. I was a boom operator. I was an apprentice editor. I was a sound effects editor. I was a music editor. It was sort of like no one's being paid, so everyone has to do everything. And these were great experiences. I had such a good time. I made so many friends, and it was you're working 16-hour days. You're getting 5-hour turnaround. Turnaround means for the time you leave until the time you have to come back. Mm-hmm. So you're going home. You're showering. You're sleeping for 3 hours. And you're coming back to the set. My starting salary was $15 a day for a 16-hour day, approximately. And it was the best time of my life. And sort of those memories of just the fun of a bunch of young people trying to break in, and we're on a real movie set. Mm-hmm. And we can't actually afford to rent an actual microphone boom from the sound house because that would be another $3 a day. And so – but Lars has a hockey stick, and we're going to tape the boom mic to the end of the hockey stick, and that's good enough. Mm-hmm. And you're cutting every corner like that as you can, because really all you can afford is the film stock and the Panavision camera rental, mm-hmm. and everything else is just let's put on a show.
Yeah,
and so that experience of sort of like how much it means to people who are trying to start out just to be on a set was mm-hmm. a lot of what the joy of the movie Ed Wood was about.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into the groove of writing about real people?
Well, I think when Ed Wood was not a financial success, but it was a huge critical success. And mm-hmm. it made everyone in town look at us differently. And it won Academy Awards. It won Golden Globes. It was a very special film. And I think because we had been typecast as the problem child guys earlier in our career mm-hmm. – we all of a sudden looked at this as almost like an opportunity. Like, wait a second, maybe this genre we could make a home in. In a weird way, we looked at the biographical genre, the biopic, and just saw kind of how awful it was. I mean, usually it's these 3-hour really dull films with someone in old age makeup talking to a reporter, and you go here, you go there, it's a cradle to the grave. There's a reason why, you know, the biopic genre is kind of looked down on a bit, except around Oscar time. Mm-hmm. And we thought, you know what, we could give it a kick in the ass a bit. We could take him into a different realm. And so we sort of came up with this idea of sort of what we call the anti-great man biopic, which is biographies of someone who traditionally wouldn't deserve it. Mm-hmm. And we also knew that we maybe could, you know, at least maybe get one more through the system. Mm-hmm. And so we had when Scott and I were in college was the same time that Larry Flint was in court almost every day in Los Angeles throwing oranges at the judge and wearing a diaper and all that kind of stuff. And so when we were in college, we always would read these stories and we would joke that it almost read like Marsh Brothers routines mm-hmm. like in the courtroom. And so we said, well, what about a movie about Larry Flint? And we pitched it to Columbia, and they loved it. They were like, this is a Frank Capra movie with porn. And so we were like, my God, they really
a phrase I never thought I'd hear.
Exactly.
Right. Well, when you're hearing that on the Columbia lot, it's exciting.
Yes. So that happened, and that also was nominated for Oscars, and we won a Golden Globe. And so it was one of those things where we realized that we were good at this. And so
and you had the good fortune in both cases. I mean, Ed Wood was directed by Tim Burton, and Johnny Depp gave just a wonderful performance, right. and Martin Landau too, of course. Right. The whole cast is great in Ed Wood. And then People versus Larry Flint, you had another great director, Milos Forman,
yes.
At the helm, and another, you know, wonderful cast, breathing your words, giving them life.
What was also interesting for us, though, too, was because – when the problem child movies were kind of disposable. Mm-hmm. When you write a family comedy, they can mm-hmm. fire you at any point
yeah.
and bring in another jokester to come in and make right. it funnier or something like this. We found on these movies, because the subject matters were so obscure and so fringe, that they sort of couldn't get rid of us in a weird way. We got a lot more control and power than screenwriters in Hollywood tend to get, because someone would ask one of these world class, you're talking about two of the best directors of all time, a question about about Tor Johnson or what did Bella's house look like, and mm-hmm. oh, I think Scott and Larry have a picture. Mm-hmm. And so we were like actually involved in the production of the film. We were meeting with costume designers and production designers and on the set and talking to the actors about the real people or sometimes even bringing the real people to the set. And so all of a sudden we were, you know, even though we're not credited as producers on some of those films, we acted more in that mode. Mm-hmm. And we were like – and that we liked a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
What's been kind of cool with the biopics is, I mean, they've all been period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost feel like period pieces don't get dated the way other movies do if they're made well. I mean, if they're made poorly, I mean, you can look at a movie set in the 1930s and go, oh my God, this was shot in 1968. You can just kind of smell it. But I mean, all of our movies, I mean, Tim did such a wonderful job on the two movies, and Milos did a great job on the two movies. And it's been really kind of thrilling that these movies really have lived on, in just in terms of, you know, HBO and Showtime just running these movies into the ground. And I've seen so many of my kids' friends discover, you know, People versus Larry Flint, because it's always on HBO, and mm-hmm. and it's really nice to sort of see that these movies live on, because it's not like, oh, you're watching a movie locked into 1996.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it feels very authentic to a 70s piece.
Mm-hmm. How did the Man in the Moon come about?
Man in the Moon came about. What was funny is that Andy Kaufman was someone that Scott and I had discussed doing a movie about. And after us kind of looking into it, we loved all the stories, but we kind of rejected it because he was such a hard person to lock down.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the Larry Flint production. Milo Schwarman and Danny DeVito came to us and said, what do you think of Andy Kaufman? And we were like, oh, we talked about it too. And so even though we had a little bit of like, can you actually turn this person's life into a movie? There's nothing Scott and I like more than a challenge. Almost mm-hmm. like a lot of our movies, I feel like almost like a dare. Like, can you make us sympathize for the publisher of Hustler magazine?
Mm-hmm.
So we said yes, and then we went on once again, there was no book on Andy Kaufman, and so we went on a lot of these movies. We spend so much time in research, just really, interviewing the real people.
I mean, studios would have to get very patient with us. Almost all the biopics, we spent 1 year just on the first draft.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Because we spent half that year just interviewing people mm-hmm. and going, down into the microfiche of the UCLA
mm-hmm.
research library and just being journalists and trying to put the story together. Because, a story like Andy Kaufman's or Margaret Walter Keane's, sort of on the surface, it just makes no sense. You just can't mm-hmm. even figure it out. So you want to dig as deep as you can to try to figure out what the narrative is here,
mm-hmm.
right? Because these are such mysterious people.
Right. Now, you just alluded to your most recent feature film, which is Big Eyes.
Yes.
About the real story of Margaret Keane and her husband, Walter Keane, which tell briefly, if you can, how long it took to get that movie made.
Oh, golly. That movie took—
Briefly, say it took forever.
12 years. It was sort of a— It was kind of a disaster that we wouldn't give up on it. And we were trying to direct it ourselves for many, many years. And everyone loved the script. And we kept having movie stars come in and attach themselves and producers come in and attach themselves and financiers in quotation marks
mm-hmm.
come in. And we scouted that movie in Los Angeles, in Portland, in San Francisco, in Vancouver, in New Orleans, in Baton Rouge, and in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Yeah.
And all
each,
these—
Each for a production that was about to happen.
Each for a different production. And each one of these meant tearing up the old production, mm-hmm. starting over with a new line producer, with a new budget, with a new schedule. And so, and this is us, me and Larry, like dumbbells, funding all of this out of our own pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those stop and starts would be months.
Mm.
Because you got a new guy saying, well, our city doesn't really have any beaches. So the beach scene will have to be a second unit. we can double parts of San Francisco, but we don't have any hills in our city. So that'll have to be a second unit. And each jigsaw puzzle was a different one.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, I mean, literally it was years. And if you look at us carefully at IMDb, you can sort of see some big blocks of time where you go, what were Scott and Larry doing for all those years? And it's like, well, they were prepping Big Eyes, but not actually shooting it. And we had lots of cinematographers and lots of production designers, and it was ridiculous. And then it'd be like, oh, hey, we got Reese Witherspoon and Ryan Reynolds, and we have a start date. Oh my God, and we have financing. We're going, and it just got announced in the trades. It's real, yay! Oh, she's pregnant. Okay, let's go back home. And so this went on and on, and finally we basically shot out a Hail Mary to Tim saying, hey, do you want to direct this thing?
Now, Tim Burton had attached himself as a producer.
Yes. Tim was a big fan of the script, and Tim's always been a big friend of the court. And
a fan of Margaret's art. He was a collector of Margaret's art.
He met Margaret,
and he knew Margaret, and so he was on it as a producer for a long time. And was hesitant to take over as director because he didn't want to like feel like he was stepping on our toes. And we're just like, please, this movie needs to get made.
Yeah, we just got to a point where it's like baby needs new shoes. We just have to ship it, get it off the desk, move on with our lives, and we knew Tim would do a great job.
Right. Which he did.
Yes, he did.
Which he did. And actually it's his smallest scale movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weirdly enough, it was done for less money than and had less shooting days than Ed Wood, which was 20 years earlier, and that was done in black and white, and that was his sort of art film for every 20 years we come into Tim Burton's life and make him do an art film.
Yeah.
But it turned out really well.
Yes. Amy Adams won the Golden Globe for the movie.
Yeah, and Christoph Waltz is wonderful in it, and it has a great sense of time and place and atmosphere. Which is one of the most appealing things about it, I think.
Well, for you film buffs, or at least for you, Leonard, I mean, the movie we talked about a lot when we were writing it was Sweet Smell of Success. And because a lot of the movie took place in nightclubs. And when you think of nightclubs in Hollywood movies, it's that big MGM soundstage with 100 tables with white linen tablecloths and waiters in tuxedos and welcome, so good to see you tonight, sir.
I've never been to that nightclub in real life. Yeah. The nightclub doesn't exist in Vegas.
And there's a 20-piece big band on stage and a beautiful singer. It's all that.
Right.
And our time period was with late 50s and we were in San Francisco and Sweet Smell of Success is New York. But it was very similar in that the jazz clubs were more underground, and they were literally underground. They were being built into the basement of old buildings. And so what you had is a lot of really nicely dressed people shoving themselves into a very tight fit, sweaty space. And they're all shouting over each other, and there's no room to even turn around. And that seemed really cool. And to me, it's sort of like what I think of when I think of Sweet Smell of Success, which is just a really cool movie. And I'm not sure anyone had really kind of captured that vibe since that movie. And so we talked about that a lot in all our different configurations. And then when Tim came on, we talked about it with him. And
yeah,
you get that feel.
And it was based on the real events and places in San Francisco. I mean, the Hungry Eye and the Purple Onion. These were major nightclubs at the time. And that is where Walter Keane did – rent the walls from Enrico Banducci at the Hungry Eye, and that's where the big eye paintings began to catch on.
Now, if it's not too painful, you can shut me down. Right. Can you talk about some of your projects, two in particular I'm curious about, that almost happened didn't happen?
Oh, no.
The Marx Brothers.
I'm sorry. The Marx Brothers is interesting. It's a very good script, and it's about people that we obviously care a great deal about. I would say almost there are two reasons probably why it didn't get made. One is it's quite expensive. There's no cheap version of it. There's no indie version of it. It has almost hesitate to use the word gangs in New York, but it kind of feels this big thing where there's all the brothers and they're constantly getting on trains and going to another vaudeville theater and coming out to Hollywood. This is a lot. It's a big sprawling epic. And the other hand, it also is I was talking earlier about our anti-great man biopics. This is the first biopic we wrote about someone who actually deserves a biopic. We were actually big fans of the script. But I do think that our secret sauce is making you care about people you wouldn't think you'd care about, and this script doesn't quite have that.
But I love it. I'll give props to Leonard. I was a Marx Brothers freak when I was a kid, starting from about the age of 9 or 10, and your book Movie Comedy Teams. I was always rereading over and over, double checking facts. So it meant a lot to us to get that script done, and we got to hang out with all the surviving family members.
That was cool.
All the brothers were obviously gone, but we did get to spend an afternoon with Harpo's widow Susan, and then we met a bunch of the kids, And I sort of our thesis was treating the Marxists as sort of the first punk rockers, in that they were deconstructing the idea of the entertainment and breaking the fourth wall and ignoring the script and addressing the audience. And just, you know, the fact that, you know, that when a love ballad, you know, begins in a Marx Brothers movie, Groucho can just turn to the audience and say, you know, I'm stuck here, but you people should go out into the lobby until this thing blows over.
Yeah.
And that kind of the meta postmodernism is so much fun. And I think we had a lot of fun trying to write in their voices.
That was great.
Which I love the script. I don't know how we would get it made. I mean, the problem became going movie star shopping, and we actually got one of the biggest movie stars in the world who said, "I will play Groucho." And we thought, "Oh my God, we're a go." And then this dude came back with, "Who's playing Harpo?" This is like, "Oh my God, if you're going to have to play that game through Groucho, Harpo, Chico, Zeppo, and Gummo, if you got to come up with five movie stars, it's just never going to happen." Yeah.
And also the other thing that script is really about is about being professionally brothers. Mm-hmm. About they were in show business since they were really young, and having to basically spend your entire life where your business is being a brother, and how that, you know, how that either rips the family apart or keeps them all together. And there was a lot of good stuff in the script about that.
Well, for you freaky film buffs, and I'm assuming you're out there because you're listening to Leonard's podcast. Just reading a new Marx book I just discovered called The Annotated Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like Larry and I always do with these kind of books, you know, you flip to the end first. And so I was reading the Night in Casablanca and Love Happy chapters, which are filled with lots of really interesting behind-the-scenes stories of just Groucho fed up with being part of this team. And it's – I mean, these guys have been a professional act since they were, you know, 14.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's 60. And he's like, why do I have to keep doing this? I know Chico's broke again, but why is this my problem? Here, I'll give Chico $5,000 so I don't have to act in this damn movie. And it's interesting watching sort of like those two final films get made, and then even like some of the later TV stuff, and them, you know, begging Groucho to come in for the great incredible jewel robbery. Coming for one shot.
Yeah.
Just that way the studio has more to sell.
Yeah.
I do want to talk for a second. What Scott just glossed over was our perversion for the end of the career as opposed to the beginning of the career. That when we do we get sent a lot of showbiz bios, and we do always skip to the final chapters first. I just got the second volume of the Sinatra thing, and I'm like, what do they have to say about Dirty Dingus McGee? That was really the first thing that I looked up.
We got sent the new Bob Hope book, and both of us immediately went to I'll Take Sweet It,
because that's the stuff that's interesting.
Anybody can write about, you know, Cat and the Canary. Right. That's easy.
Oh, well. Now, the other project that came very, 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 very close to happening was your Robert Ripley.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry to do this. I'm sorry. I'm curious.
These
are both the same time period.
Yeah. Ripley, of course, is the guy who invented Ripley's Believe It or Not.
It's strange that both projects you brought up were are two roaring 20s scripts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, true.
Everyone's talking Jimmy Cagney. They're talking really fast. Listen here.
I would say definitely in the Ripley script. I thought we captured that cadence, that sort of cadence.
Early talky cadence.
Yeah, we would always look back at the moments in the Thin Man movies where William Powell would be getting off a train and the reporter's like, "Hey, Nick, tell us a story.
Give us the lowdown, Nick." And everyone's talking like that.
That's really what reporters were called, boys. Now, boys, hang on.
Boys, hang on. I got time for all of you.
Yeah, we're not on the case. We're just not on the case. So, but Ripley definitely has that feel, and Ripley is a terrific script. Ripley was our attempt to do a hybrid, which is half of a real biography and half of an adventure story,
which is totally made up.
Yeah, where everything about Ripley's life and all the people he hung out with are totally real in the script, But then he stumbles onto a, believe it or not, that leads him into a kind of an Indiana Jones-esque adventure.
Okay.
We wound up doing a similar thing on a film that came out earlier this year called Goosebumps, mm-hmm. where we took that a kind of same approach with R.L. Stein, the person mm-hmm. who wrote the Goosebumps books, where we actually sort of wrote a bit about about R.L. Stein, but it kind of really invented him as a character, and mm-hmm. he actually gets pulled into this monster mash when his books turn out to have real monsters in them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But and who was going to star in the Ripley movie?
It was Jim Carrey. It was Tim Burton. I'll take back my joke earlier that we never get paid with Tim, because on Ripley's we got paid. The trade off was the movie didn't get made.
Yeah.
And that one was prepping in China, prepping in London. Oh my God, the artwork for the sets was so beautiful. I mean, it would have been such a spectacular movie, and it imploded for.
One thing I don't understand is why we always get asked about projects that didn't happen. When other writers come in or directors come in, people don't talk about that.
Well, that's not necessarily. But also, you know those.
So when Ridley Scott comes in, they don't say, "Tell us about Crisis in the Hot Zone."
Yes, exactly.
No, well, but hang on a second. In fairness,
I didn't even get a laugh.
No. But in fairness, we have talked about your most successful movies, right. And those two projects are so intriguing to me.
Well, Ripley would have been our most successful film. That's the drag. That was the one time where Larry and I were like totally swinging for the fences, saying, "This is so great. We've taken all our own obsessions and we've grafted them into this big, fat commercial movie that everyone in the world is going to love. This is a movie for everyone, but it ended up being a movie for no one because it didn't get made." Mm-hmm.
Still in development somewhere, though, believe it or not.
Well, I hope. There's still hope then.
No.
There's still hope.
It won't resemble what we wrote.
I realize that we should take a little break here before we come back. What we're going to do with our guests today is we're going to ask Scott and Larry, as we always do, to recommend some unsung or underrated films that they are fond of that you might want to see. And we'll do that in just a minute.
Star Wars.
Today's show is sponsored by Howl FM. It's like Netflix for podcasts. With Howl Premium, you'll get exclusive access to dozens of original Howl miniseries, like The Mysterious Secrets of Uncle Bertie's Botanarium, a richly sound-designed adventure comedy starring Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords. Access it all on your iPhone, your Android phone, or on the web for only $4.99 a month. And if you use the promo code MALTIN at checkout, you'll get a full month for free. That's MALTIN, and you'll get a full month free of charge. Check it out, howl.fm. Welcome back to Maltin on Movies. I'm Leonard Maltin, and my guests today are Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, screenwriters, film buffs, all-around good guys.
Thanks, Leonard.
We like you too, Leonard.
Well, thank you. Well, now comes the time of our show. Now comes the time when I'm going to ask you to recommend a movie to our listeners. And why don't you go first, Scott?
Okay, because I'm not prepared. Okay, I will recommend one of my favorite movies I saw as a kid. I didn't see it in the theater. The first time I saw it on the Z Channel, which is called The Last of Sheila. It came out in 1973, and it is a fabulous whodunit comic murder mystery. I know I'm making it sound cheesy. It was written by Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins.
Yep.
And you can really feel the cleverness, which is really what just carries that screenplay along. It's a puzzle movie, sort of in the Agatha Christie school, but with a lot of clues and a lot of twists. The backstory is that Sondheim and Perkins were puzzle fanatics, and they used to make puzzles to amuse each other, and then they used to have puzzle parties, and they used to organize these very elaborate scavenger hunts in New York City, where they'd invite all of Stephen Sondheim's famous friends, and they'd come over, and then they would go running around New York City trying to crack the puzzle and come back with the prize first. And they took that idea and then there were none kind of a structure where it's a group of people in an isolated place. So in this movie, it's a Hollywood satire, and it's about a bunch of kind of has-been or floundering Hollywood characters led by James Coburn as this manipulating producer who invites a bunch of his, I guess the current term would be frenemies, mm-hmm. which is people he's worked with.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie star. There's a screenwriter. There's a director. And everyone is in some kind of career free fall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one-year anniversary of the hit-and-run death of his wife, Sheila. And I don't know why he's – I can't remember why he seems to be celebrating the one-year anniversary of her death. But he invites his six friends aboard his yacht in the Mediterranean. And so it's James Coburn. It's Raquel Welch as the movie star, Ian McShane as her kind of sleazy manager husband, James Mason as a has-been – director who was once great but is now directing TV commercials.
Diane Cannon,
who's basically playing Sue Mengers, the hottest talent agent of the early 70s. Richard Benjamin as a floundering screenwriter and Joan Hackett as his alcoholic wife. Hmm. And Coburn announces they're going to spend the week playing games where each person has been given a pretend secret. And each night they're going to go off into a different Mediterranean port and run around these really just beautiful old cobblestone cities and look for clues and try to find each person's pretend secret each night.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience is sort of trying to play the game as the characters are playing the game.
Right.
And what we start to realize is these are not pretend secrets.
Don't say too much more.
Okay. Well, I won't give away any more than was in the marketing in terms of you are an alcoholic. You are a little child molester. And these seem like, oh, well, I'm certainly not a little child molester. People start to realize, wait a minute, someone else on the boat may be a little child molester. And then people start to realize the person who killed Sheila may be on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then people start dying. And it's so much fun. It's got so much bitchy, catty Hollywood humor. Everyone is just in a constant put-down mode.
Mm-hmm.
Mocking each other. I mean, Diane Cannon is so friggin' funny as this sort of oversexed, pithy Hollywood. I mean, she's the only kind of big shot on the boat, and she's sleeping with every sailor who's working on the boat, And it's so full of clever surprises, and the movie, the construction of the script is so good. The movie doesn't cheat anything. There's a lot of clues that are given to you that you don't realize you're seeing the clues, mm-hmm. and then the movie wraps up with so many good choices. And you go, oh my God! So it always plays honest. It's interesting. Is I always wondered, why they didn't write more movies, and I was just Googling it because I knew I was coming in here to see you. And I guess Stephen Sondheim and Tony Perkins did write a couple more murder mystery scripts, but sadly they just disappeared into development hell.
Well, wow. Lem's going to ask them when they come on. Can you tell us about the scripts that didn't get made, Mr. Sondheim? Forget about West Side Story. I don't really want to talk about that. But tell us about the scripts that didn't get made.
I don't know if I'm stressing enough that the movie is so much fun.
Well, it's fun. I am not a fan of puzzle movies. Like mm-hmm. I always tend to think that they're overly constructed, and mm-hmm. I feel like that once you know the puzzle, it's no longer worth mm-hmm. watching, or it's not repeatable. But that being said, I'm a huge fan of Last of Sheila. It's mm-hmm. it's a complete hoot, and everybody is at the top of their game, and it's really well directed by Herbert Ross and.
Very, very ingenious,
yeah.
As you would expect from those two guys
yes.
putting their heads together.
Absolutely.
And must have been a dream project for them, I would think.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of the movie, Leonard?
I like it a lot. I haven't seen it in years. I mean, I'm going on a distant memory of it, but I remember enjoying it very much. And the word that comes to mind is clever.
It's right. clever, and it's really fun as a period, as a piece of history, in that it really is – New Hollywood, early 70s.
Yeah.
That
it captures
that
it really
world
well.
Is right. yeah, it's captured so nicely.
Yeah. And your choice today, Larry?
Well, strange enough, I actually do a Trailers from Hell on Last of Sheila, as well as the movie that I picked for today, which is Albert Brooks's movie Real Life.
Yay!
Merely one of the great comedies of all time.
Thank you. I agree. But it's
I agree.
You know, when the movie was first released, it made literally $300,000 in theaters. I mean, so it was funny. During the last Oscar season, we got to hang out a little bit with Tarantino. And Tarantino always says that a movie's you can't judge a movie by its first run at the box office. Mm-hmm. That you know, wait 10 years and what people really think of the movie will start to come to the surface. And I feel that's what's happened with Real Life. It actually is – a lot of films are said to be before its time, and Real Life is definitely one of those.
It was very much of its time because it was parodying.
Well, it was parodying one thing, which was the PBS show American Family, the Loud Family. Basically, the PBS did the first reality show, which was a documentary series about an American family, and you saw a family become torn apart on television.
And the crew lived with them for a year.
Correct. Yeah. And it was a sensation on public television, and Albert used that as a way to make a fake documentary. Strange enough, it also predates Christopher Guest movies in that sense, where Albert is really making the first mockumentary.
Yep.
Which was interesting. I mean, Albert was one of the first postmodern comedians to begin with. I mean, there was that sort of movement in the early 70s of comedians who were making comedy about comedy, whether it was Albert Brooks or Steve Martin's, you know, comedy is not pretty kind of thing, or Andy Kaufman, where they're almost more performance artists, sometimes not even that interested in making you laugh as much as making you squirm. And Albert was kind of the king of that, and he had
– what's the not comedy minus –
Comedy Minus One. He made two great, I think the two best
brilliant
comedy albums of all time. Or one is Comedy Minus One, which is half the album is a parody of these records that were called Co-Star, which basically were these albums that were plays missing one part.
Yeah, and they gave you a script.
They gave you a script.
You could act opposite Vincent Price.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. I had a couple of these
records. And the title is for Music Minus One.
Yeah. Right.
Which were for aspiring musicians.
Right. Yeah. But the genius album of Albert Brooks is an album called A Star Is Bought, where it's basically about its own marketing concept, which is Albert made a record, an album, where every single cut was designed to be a hit on a different format radio station. And it goes from blues to talk radio to classical to, and it's an insane album.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of these were actually financially successful, but they led Albert and starting making short films. He made a brilliant short film for a PBS show called
The Famous Comedian School of Westport, Connecticut.
There you go, exactly. And it's once again another fake documentary about a school that will teach you how to be funny.
Yeah. Albert also made a lot of shorts for the first season of SNL. Saturday,
correct. Saturday, and I think that's being a part of that first SNL cast, which had such a huge impact on the media that gave him the freedom to make his first movie. And what's interesting in all those shorts and in this film, he's playing a character named Albert Brooks, which is also completely mind-blowing and postmodern. That he's actually playing a version of himself, and the fact that he doesn't spend one moment making himself likable
in
any way whatsoever.
Not at all, the opposite.
But the movie is extremely funny, it's extremely dark, and it really, when you watch it now, you can't believe this happened before Real World and before the Kardashians, because it's all about how having a camera in the room examining "quote unquote" real life changes real life completely.
Yeah,
it's a very deep film, but it's also a very, very funny film. I mean, there's a running joke of the movie with the camera equipment.
The Etten Hour. Only five ever made. Only four ever worked, and we had three of those.
Exactly. And there's basically deep sea diving helmets that are supposed to be allow them to fade into the background, but it's every time they walk through the frame, it's hysterical. So it's a movie I love a great deal.
I love it too, but I also love the trailer for
Real Life. That's why
one of the Great right. trailers of all time.
Once again, it's a postmodern trailer. It's a trailer that's aware it's a trailer.
Yes.
It's a trailer that's
not even about the movie.
It's not about the movie. There's not even one shot from the movie in the trailer.
Yeah.
It's the trailer is in quote unquote 3D, but it's not really in 3D. And it's basically Albert talking about his movie and bringing in someone who
Albert's pitching his movie.
Wait. Albert says, if you reach under your seat now, please put on your 3D glasses.
Right.
And then a little caption starts flashing to the bottom of the screen saying, may not be available in all theaters.
So it's a genius trailer, and it is available on Trailers from Hell. Both, you can watch just a trailer or you can watch it with my commentary.
Wonderful.
And to do a shout out to Albert, I mean, real life and his next film, Modern Romance,
Modern Romance
are so influential on me and Larry. Mm-hmm. We loved Albert and Albert's character and Albert's kind of comedy so much. I mean, this idea of this driven, passionate, wrong person, I mean, really sort of became the prototype for almost all of our biopics, mm-hmm. right? Which is about this person with really strongly held convictions who is just incorrect. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny, and this person becomes more and more desperate as the story goes along, and we loved him so much that the very first script Larry and I ever wrote, which we sold, the lead character was named Albert Brooks. we weren't doing what Albert does in real life, which is I'm playing the comedian Albert Brooks. Mm-hmm. This was simply a movie about a suburban dad who has a bunch of funny things happen to him, but we loved him. And then friends who read the first draft said, you guys want Albert to play the part? We go, oh, yeah. You understand? You need to make up a name for the character. it's like writing a script for Clark Gable and just typing the name Clark Gable in the script. We didn't understand this.
And also, I think something about real life and his second film, Modern Romance, that is not really ever discussed is how they really are two of the best movies about movie making.
Oh, and show business in general.
Yeah, yes. Just the scenes in Modern Romance in the editing room. Or the sound mix.
Oh, the sound guys.
I think you saved the picture, right?
It's just, it's just
Hulk Redding.
It's perfect. That is perfect. Yeah. And we think Albert's a genius.
He is. Well, that's because it's a fact.
Yes. And his real name is Albert Einstein. So I guess that's sort of.
Gets points for that, too.
If you're going to be a genius, you should be named Albert Einstein. Right.
That's funny.
You know, I see by the old clock on the wall, as they used to say. We're out of time, which is a shame because we could keep going.
The old time radio hour.
Maybe sometime you guys will come back. Maybe I can persuade you to come back for more chatter.
We'll talk about our television show next time, The People versus O.J. Simpson.
No, for another time.
I'm going to plug it. That's all.
Gee, I'm so sorry, guys. We didn't get to talk about your current television project. People will just have to go to the 1,000 other outlets where everybody's talking about the show. It is a sensational show. It is a remarkable – it is really a television event. I hate that phrase when they are doing hype and promos. But you've created a television event, you and Ryan
Murphy. Like the Winds of War.
Yeah. and you're to be congratulated no end. I mean, you just have a gift for doing this kind of reality, unreality.
Thank you.
And it's I'm very happy for its success and for your success with it. And I don't know what more to say, but congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I hope you're basking in the glow of its success.
Not right this second.
Okay, fine. Well, maybe soon.
When you get out of the room, maybe
soon. Okay, fine. We'll watch you bask outside. Right. And folks, thanks for tuning in, as always. We will be back next week with more good stuff and more recommendations for you. Until then, I am on Twitter, as you know, at Leonard Maltin, and online with my website at leonardmaltin.com. Thank you for tuning in. Tell your friends. Tell anybody you meet on the street. Tell anybody. We need listeners. Bring them in. Get them in the tent, as P.T. Barnum used to say. And take care. Talk to you next time.
Hi, guys. Danielle Schneider here.
Eileen, you've done it again.
As you know, Casey Wilson and I are obsessed with All the Real Housewives.
Eileen would be the cheapest, best date because you could give her Claire's and she would think it's Cartier.
So that's why we started Bitch Sesh, a Real Housewives breakdown show. And we've got some really exciting news. Starting this week, we're going to cover the brand new season of Real Housewives of New York City. Yes!
Is Erica here tonight?
Maybe she is, bitches.
So look for new episodes every Thursday morning. Bitch Sesh is coming to the Big Apple, only on Earwolf.
On this podcast, I'll admit you come off like a little nasty.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.